Hello and welcome to Roots of Today, the podcast where the past meets the present. With every episode, we journey through time, uncovering the lessons, parallels, and connections between historical milestones and current events to create a deeper understanding of the compelling stories and issues that shape the news. The assassination of Charlie Kirk while speaking to students on a Utah college campus had brought the topic of political violence to the forefront of our national discourse. While Kirk was not a political office holder himself, his presence as a political speaker and his work recruiting young voters to the conservative side of the political spectrum had a major impact on not only the 2024 presidential election, which saw Donald Trump return to the White House, but he also greatly improved the Republicans' prognosis for the midterm elections in 2026. How his assassination will affect the political fortunes of both parties is something that will be better discussed after years have passed and historians have the benefit of hindsight on their side. But if his memorial service, one that drew over 100,000 people to attend, and one where speaker after speaker vowed to expand the mission that Kirk founded, is any indication, it appears the short-term result will favor the political fortunes of the GOP as well. In this episode, we are going to look at the political assassinations and their political consequences involving three men that have been mostly forgotten by the mainstream American public: President James Garfield, President William McKinley, and Senator Huey Long of Louisiana. As always, this is Alan, your host, reminding you to grab your coffee, tea, or whatever beverage you prefer as we dive right into the topic at hand. James Abram Garfield's rise to the presidency was as unlikely as his tragic fall. Born in 1831 in a log cabin in Ohio, Garfield grew up poor, worked as a canal boy, and through sheer determination made his way into higher education and eventually politics. A Civil War general and later a congressman, Garfield never set out to become president. In fact, at the Republican National Convention of 1880, he was there only to nominate another candidate. But after 36 ballots and a deadlocked convention, delegates turned to Garfield as a compromise choice. Garfield entered the White House in March 1881 with a reputation for honesty and integrity, but he quickly found himself at the center of the battle over political patronage. At the time, government jobs were often handed out as rewards to party loyalists, the notorious spoils system. Garfield, skeptical of corruption, tried to resist the constant demands for offices and appointments. His refusal to play the game earned him enemies and, tragically, helped create the conditions for his assassination. Charles Guiteau, the man who would kill Garfield, was a delusional and unstable drifter who fancied himself a political thinker. He had written a rambling speech supporting Garfield during the campaign and convinced himself that his contribution entitled him to a prestigious diplomatic post. When Garfield's administration ignored his requests, Guiteau's frustration boiled over into violent obsession. Convinced that God had chosen him to remove the president, Guiteau bought a revolver and began stalking Garfield. On the morning of July 2, 1881, Garfield prepared to leave Washington, D.C. for a trip to New England. At the Baltimore and Potomac Railroad Station, accompanied by two of his sons and Secretary of State James Blaine, Garfield walked through the waiting area. Guiteau approached from behind and fired two shots. One grazed Garfield's arm, and the other lodged deep inside his back near the pancreas. The president collapsed to the floor, bleeding and in shock. Had Garfield received competent medical care, he might have survived. But what followed was a disaster. American doctors in 1881 largely dismissed the new European theories of antiseptic surgery pioneered by Joseph Lister. Instead, Garfield's physicians repeatedly probed his wound with unsterilized fingers and instruments, introducing infection with every attempt. Alexander Graham Bell even devised a metal detector to try to locate the bullet, but interference from the metal bed frame gave false readings. For 79 agonizing days, Garfield lingered. At first, he seemed to rally, even joking with visitors, but abscesses spread through his body, and his weight dropped dramatically. Through the summer heat, doctors tried in vain to stabilize him, moving him to the Jersey Shore in hopes that fresh air would help. Nothing worked. On September 19, 1881, Garfield died of massive infection and internal hemorrhage. He had been president for only 200 days, the second shortest tenure in U.S. history, after William Henry Harrison. The nation was stunned. Many mourned not only Garfield's death, but the cruel, drawn-out suffering that preceded it. Newspapers debated whether it was Guiteau or the doctors who had truly killed the president. Guiteau himself seemed to share that view. At his trial, he infamously declared, "The doctors killed Garfield, I just shot him." He was nonetheless convicted of murder and executed in 1882. Garfield's assassination had profound political consequences. Vice President Chester A. Arthur, a man previously tied to New York's corrupt political machine, now occupied the presidency. Few expected Arthur to rise above his patronage past. Yet the shock of Garfield's murder and the national disgust with the spoils system inspired him to back reform. In 1883, Arthur signed the Pendleton Civil Service Reform Act, which began replacing patronage with a merit-based system for government jobs. In this sense, Garfield's death, as senseless as it was, became a turning point. It forced the United States to confront the dangers of political corruption and the inefficiencies of its government. The tragedy also underscored the importance of modern medicine. In Europe, antiseptic surgery was saving lives. In America, stubborn adherence to old practices had killed a president. James Garfield is not remembered with the grandeur of Lincoln or Kennedy, but his assassination reshaped American government. His short presidency ended not only by a gunman's bullet, but by the failures of contemporary medicine, left behind a legacy of reform born out of tragedy. William McKinley's presidency was defined by prosperity and empire. Elected in 1896, at the height of economic depression, McKinley restored confidence in the nation's finances with his staunch support for the gold standard. He was a calm, affable leader, a sharp contrast to the fiery orators of his age. Under his steady hand, America waged and won the Spanish-American War in 1898, gaining control of Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines. For many, McKinley symbolized the quiet conservatism of the late 19th century, cautious, deliberate, and reluctant to embrace sweeping change. But beneath the surface, America was shifting rapidly. Industrialization and urbanization were remaking society. Immigrants crowded cities, labor unions grew restless, and across the world, radical movements, especially anarchism, were spreading. In Europe, anarchists had assassinated kings, presidents, and prime ministers. By 1901, the United States was not immune to those same currents of discontent. On September 6, 1901, McKinley traveled to Buffalo, New York, to attend the Pan American Exposition, a world's fair showcasing American progress and technology. That afternoon, inside the Temple of Music, the president stood in a receiving line to greet the public. Hundreds of visitors queued up to shake his hand. One of them was Leon Czolgosz, a 28-year-old anarchist of Polish descent who had become obsessed with the writings of radicals like Emma Goldman. Believing he was striking a blow against tyranny, Czolgosz concealed a revolver beneath a handkerchief wrapped around his hand, pretending to have an injury. When he reached the president, Czolgosz fired two shots at point-blank range. One bullet grazed McKinley's chest, the other tore into his abdomen. The president collapsed into the arms of his aides as chaos erupted. Czolgosz was immediately seized and beaten by the crowd, but McKinley, ever composed, reportedly told his men not to harm him. At first, it seemed McKinley might survive. Surgeons operated quickly, removing one bullet, but failing to locate the second. He rallied over the next few days, his color returning, his spirits high. The nation sighed with relief. Newspapers praised his resilience. Vice President Theodore Roosevelt, vacationing in the Adirondacks, was assured that the president was recovering. But infection soon set in. The unremoved bullet had damaged his stomach and pancreas, and gangrene began to spread. On September 13th, McKinley took a sudden turn for the worse. Realizing the end was near, he whispered to his wife, "It is God's way. His will, not ours, be done early the next morning." On September 14th, the 25th President of the United States died. He was 58 years old. The nation grieved deeply. McKinley had been personally popular, a gentle figure seen as embodying small-town virtue. Yet, the grief was quickly overtaken by shock at what his death meant for the presidency. Theodore Roosevelt, just 42 years old, now stood at the threshold of power. Roosevelt's ascension marked one of the great pivots in American political history. Where McKinley was cautious, Roosevelt was bold. Where McKinley preferred compromise, Roosevelt thrived on confrontation. In foreign policy, TR brandished the Big Stick, asserting American power in the Caribbean and Pacific. Domestically, he embraced the progressive movement, taking on monopolies, conserving natural resources, and expanding the role of government in everyday life. It is difficult to overstate how transformative this shift was. Had McKinley lived, America might have drifted quietly into the new century under his conservative stewardship. Instead, Roosevelt thrust the presidency into a new role as the driver of reform and expansion. The assassination of McKinley thus became the catalyst for the progressive era, shaping policies and attitudes that endured long after Roosevelt left office. For Leon Czolgosz, there was no mercy. He was tried swiftly, convicted, and executed in the electric chair less than 2 months after the shooting. He declared that he had killed McKinley because he believed he was an enemy of the people. Yet in killing him, Czolgosz inadvertently set in motion the rise of a president who would reshape the very institutions he claimed to despise. Today, McKinley is often remembered faintly, overshadowed by Roosevelt's giant presence. His name survives in places like Mount McKinley, now restored to Denali, and in the quiet memory of a presidency ended too soon. But the real legacy of McKinley's death is the presidency it created. One bullet in Buffalo not only ended a man's life, but unleashed a leader who would redefine the office itself. In the 1930s, as the Great Depression ravaged the United States, few figures loomed larger, or more controversially, than Huey Pierce Long of Louisiana. Known as the Kingfish, Long was a brilliant orator, a ruthless political operator, and a populist whose vision of wealth redistribution electrified millions of Americans. To his supporters, he was the champion of the poor and downtrodden. To his critics, he was a dangerous demagogue with dictatorial ambitions. His assassination in 1935 cut short a career that might have rewritten the story of the New Deal and American politics. Long's rise was meteoric. Born in 1893 in the tiny town of Winfield, Louisiana, he grew up in a family of modest means, but quickly displayed a sharp mind and outsized ambition. After a stint as a traveling salesman and a law degree earned through abbreviated study, Long entered politics. By 1928, at just 34 years old, he was elected governor of Louisiana. As governor, Long built his reputation as a populist crusader. He poured money into public works. New roads, bridges, hospitals, and schools transformed the state. He championed free textbooks for children, expanded public health programs, and made higher education more accessible. Yet, he ruled Louisiana with an iron grip. Opponents accused him of corruption, intimidation, and cronyism. The state legislature became a rubber stamp for his agenda, and those who defied him often found themselves politically destroyed. In 1930, Long moved to the national stage as a U.S. senator. Even in Washington, he maintained control of Louisiana politics through loyal allies, earning him both admiration and suspicion. By 1934, with the Great Depression still grinding down the American economy, Long launched his most ambitious initiative, the Share Our Wealth program. The plan was radical for its time. Long proposed capping personal fortunes at $5 million, taxing the wealthy heavily, and redistributing wealth so that every American family could receive a guaranteed income, a home, and educational opportunities. He promised pensions for the elderly and financial support for veterans. His slogan, "Every Man a King," captured the imagination of millions. By 1935, Long claimed to have tens of thousands of Share Our Wealth clubs across the country, boasting millions of members. This growing movement put him on a collision course with President Franklin D. Roosevelt. Long had initially supported FDR, but quickly soured on the New Deal, dismissing it as too timid. Roosevelt, in turn, considered Long one of the most dangerous men in America. As the 1936 presidential election approached, Long hinted that he might challenge Roosevelt, either as a Democrat or through a third-party run. Some speculated he could siphon enough votes to throw the election into chaos, perhaps even paving the way for a Republican victory. But Long never got the chance. On September 8, 1935, he was at the Louisiana State Capitol in Baton Rouge, overseeing a late-night session. As he walked through the building's ornate corridors, Carl Weiss, the son-in-law of a political rival, confronted him. Weiss pulled a handgun and fired, Long staggered away, mortally wounded before collapsing. He died 2 days later, at the age of 42. The nation reacted with a mix of shock and relief. In Louisiana, thousands mourned their fallen leader. Across the country, many wondered what might have happened had Long lived to challenge Roosevelt. The what-if scenarios are tantalizing. Could Long's movement have fractured the Democratic Party, undermining the New Deal? Could his brand of redistributive populism have reshaped American politics decades before similar debates reemerged in later generations? Or would his authoritarian streak have plunged the nation into turmoil? Roosevelt himself privately acknowledged the significance of Long's death. Without the kingfish, the most potent populist challenge to his presidency disappeared. In 1936, Roosevelt won re-election in a landslide, carrying every state but Maine and Vermont. The New Deal went forward largely unimpeded, cementing FDR's dominance and redefining the American state. Huey Long remains one of the great what-ifs of U.S. history. His assassination not only ended the career of a singularly ambitious politician, but also silenced a movement that might have pulled America in a radically different direction during its darkest economic crisis. Was he a savior of the poor or a dangerous autocrat in the making? Historians still debate the answer. What is certain is that Long's death ensured Roosevelt's supremacy and left the kingfish as a ghost haunting the American imagination. The assassinations of James Garfield, William McKinley, and Huey Long changed the direction of history. Today, we are looking at the assassination of Charlie Kirk and left wondering what the ramifications of his murder will have on the future. For us, it is conjecture. In a century, it may be considered a point where the direction of the country made a significant course correction. Time will tell. That concludes this episode. Please like and subscribe and leave a comment if there is anything you would like to add to the debate. If there is a topic you would like to see covered, please leave a note as well. Sources for this episode and suggested readings can be found at the show notes at rootsoftoday.blog. Finally, seek out several sources for your news and information and stay informed. Most importantly, fight to keep your political representatives accountable. Your freedom depends on it.